Spectrum Business knows that you put in unlimited effort to unlock the unlimited possibilities of your small business. Get internet, mobile, phone, and TV services to connect all aspects of your business and see your business made limitless. Learn more at spectrum.com/business.
You see where your business can go. To get there, you may need
another 10 trucks.
At Century Insurance, we put more than 115 years of industry experience to work to help protect you as you
launch a new delivery service
or
expand into a new region
and reach your business goals. Century, right by you. Property and casualty coverages and underwritten and safety services are provided by a member of the Century Insurance Group, Stevens Point, Wisconsin. For a complete listing of companies, visit century.com. Policies, coverages, benefits, and discounts are not available in all states. See policy for complete coverage details.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, I think it's something that the absurdist writer Douglas Adams would have appreciated. New research into how CO2 is critical to Earth's massive transformations in the past from a lush green planet to ice age and back again, and its crucial role in global warming, has come from clams. Yes, you heard that right, clams. Here to tell me about her work is Hannah Jurakova. She's from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Hannah, you're very welcome to the programme. Could you please explain how we measure CO2? Because obviously today it's very easy to measure its concentration in the atmosphere. But how do we do that when we want to understand what those levels were like hundreds of thousands, even millions of years ago?
Hi, Jonathan. Yes, my pleasure to be on the programme. So, yeah, as you correctly say, we can measure CO2 in the atmosphere today. We've been able to do that for several decades. And we can actually go back almost a million years ago by measuring ancient air trapped in ice cores. So you go to Antarctica, you drill the ice, and you extract the ancient air, and you can measure the CO2. We can go back some more millions of years.
Yeah. You take out the ice core, and there's bubbles in there that are trapped because of the process. And then when you take the air from those bubbles, there's CO2 in that air.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So the ice in Antarctica until kind of very recently, until recent human climate change has been growing. There's probably, we now think there's almost maybe ice as old as 4 million years. But within that ice, there are tiny pockets of air. And you can drill, and the deeper you drill, essentially, the further back in Earth's time you go, and you can extract that air, and you can measure the carbon dioxide concentration in it.
Just one more question to that. How do you know that the deeper you go, the older the ice? I mean, it sounds obvious in a way, but how do we know that that ice that's very deep is actually very old?
Well, we can also, we can also date the ice sheets. I mean, it's true that it's not as trivial as that because the ice moves. But we have ways of dating the ice and then extracting CO2, and that's really formed the basis of our understanding of recent climate change and recent atmosphere and how that's been evolving on timescales of 100,000, maybe up to hundreds of thousands of years. We have records that go back currently around 800,000 of years.
Yeah. And so we've got records that go 800,000 years back. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And so when you're checking this CO2, do you need a lot of samples to be able to validate an air sample? Because obviously in a certain pocket of air, there might be more CO2 than another pocket of air, or is it all fairly heterogeneous? If you take ice from the Antarctic and compare it to ice of the same age in the Antarctic, will it have generally the same amount of CO2?
The actual amount of air trapped might be different, right? The air bubble. But yeah, sure. I mean, the air, CO2 in our Earth's atmosphere is basically globally distributed and homogeneous. Okay. So we have ice cores that we've been looking at in Antarctica, and then we have in Greenland. I'm actually not an ice core specialist, but this is kind of very closely related topic. But that's kind of what's allowed us to look into what CO2 look like in what I would call as somebody who works on much older timescales, recent past. And we can actually go back further by looking at tiny fossils trapped on the seafloor. So these are called foraminifera, and these live on seafloor. They kind of, when they die, they deposit on the seafloor. And we can similarly, as we take cores, as we drill the ice, we can drill the seafloor, get these organisms out, measure chemical fingerprints, and reconstruct CO2. And this has allowed us to look back in time roughly 60 million years. And we do have quite a good understanding. Actually, there's lots of gaps to be filled, but we do have a relatively good understanding of what kind of climate and CO2 did over the last 60 million years. To give you an idea, this is roughly from the time of the meteorite impact and the death of the dinosaurs to today.
Right.
But Earth's history is very big. So to go further back in time, we need to find new ways. And this is kind of what our research is about and kind of further back in time period we're looking at.
Yeah, so you're looking at the late Paleozoic age, which is about 300 million years ago, right? And you, rather than looking at ice cores or dinosaur, you're looking at fossils of brachiopod shells. What are brachiopods, and how on earth do you extract anything from something so ancient?
Yeah, so these are clam-like organisms. They have a calcareous shell. For if you're not a specialist in kind of clams, I guess, they're very different.
I'm not a specialist in clams.
Yeah. You could remember that they're not very good for eating. You could try to eat them, but there is not much of that kind of nice fleshy bit inside the clam that you would like to, you know, the muscle that you would like to eat. So there's not much of that mollusk organism. But they do have shells, and the shells are kind of similar to clams. And the shells are made out of a specific mineral type of calcium carbonate that is very well preserved in the geological record. So you can actually go to different places on land. One of those places actually is beneath my feet right now in St Andrews. Parts of the southeastern Scotland are carboniferous. They're around 330 million years old, and some of these shells live here. But you can go to different places and you can piece together a record of these shells in which we measure chemical fingerprints. We're looking at a specific element called boron. And with those chemical fingerprints, we can actually reconstruct CO2 and what the climate looked like.
Right. So this is the interesting part. So I'll keep hearing about boron when we talk about fossils. What is boron, and how does it help us understand the level of CO2? Because you're not actually extracting CO2. You're inferring CO2 levels from the boron. Is that right?
Yes, that's very correct. Essentially, you know, if we want to look far back in time, we don't have direct ways, but we have indicators that we can test today. You know, you can make experiments on brachiopods today, for example, because you can still find them in the ocean, and you can calibrate these tools like boron on modern organisms. So essentially, the CO2 story is written in chemical fingerprints. So it's written in the fingerprint of boron. So boron is an element. Some people might know it perhaps from salt. Boron is quite common in salt. There's things called borax, so lots of salt deposits, and it's something used in many detergents. It's a relatively common element. But the way it works in seawater is that its relative signature of its two isotopes, it's got two isotopes, its relative chemical signature changes as a function of pH, and the pH is a function of CO2.
Hmm.
So through reading the boron signatures, boron isotope signatures, we can get to pH, and then we can get to CO2. And this has really been a key tool that has informed what ocean pH and CO2 looks like on kind of timescales of, you know, all the last 60 million years, where we have the seafloor sediments, where people have been going recovering tiny, tiny fossils from the seafloor sediments. And now we've kind of discovered a way to take this approach in this new fossil type called brachiopod. I mean, it's a very old fossil, it's a very common fossil, but we've calibrated it and we've used it to reconstruct CO2 on much longer and deeper timescales.
Okay, so this is semi-complicated. So just to go through it step by step, what you do is you get fossils that are aged, that you know what age they are, and then you measure the isotopes of boron. That tells you how acidic the water in which this brachiopod lived in was, and by gauging how acidic it was, you can infer the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. Have I got that right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So, just that link between pH and CO2 levels, that's really solid in terms of our understanding. There's nothing else that might have affected the pH, or I guess you get taken off samples and you could be pretty solid. Is that the idea?
Yes. Yeah, okay. I mean, there's always some degrees of extra parameters that go into the calculations, but that link is very, very tight. And we can see that from today, from our measurements of CO2 in the atmosphere and kind of open ocean pH, and you'll see them, they go, hand in hand.
Okay, really cool. So tell us what your study has found then, when it looks at CO2 through time, having looked at these fossils and understood what sort of CO2 was in the environment 300 years ago and since, what do we know about the ebb and flow of climate change and carbon dioxide?
Right, so we looked, now we have this tool, we can essentially look at any time in Earth's fossil records. So all the way, take the history of CO2 to 500 million years ago when life radiated.
Were we never able to do that before?
Not really. I mean, there's other ways we can do it, but not to this level of accuracy and precision and kind of temporal resolution as well. There's ways, I think, science is not something that just happens. Science, I would say, gradually evolves, and you're always building on what people have done before. Mm. But I could say that we've made kind of a significant step forward now in terms of how well we can make these calculations and also how precisely we can date the fossils. So kind of we have better knowledge of when and what amounts of CO2 was. So we looked at a specific time, which is called the Late Paleozoic Ice Age. And it's an interesting time interval because as much as to us having kind of ice in Antarctica and having ice in Arctic is natural. It's all we, of course, know. It's the world in which humans have evolved and live in currently. It seems that it's kind of a relatively less common climate, background climate state in its history. So we wanted to know how this Late Paleozoic Ice Age occurred. It's a time where it's one of the oldest, perhaps it's the kind of the most intense, I think I would say, is the most intense and definitely longest lived ice age that has been witnessed by complex multicellular life. So we have animals in the ocean and on land, and we wanted to know how this ice age happened. So we reconstructed CO2, and what we can see is that the long-term climate has been closely CO2-paced. So CO2 is very low for tens of millions of years in the Carboniferous, when we have the kind of the most intense phase of this ice age. And then the ice age actually disappears quite rapidly, as we were able to show in the beginning of Permian, because of volcanic eruptions. And that transitions the global climate into warmer world. So what's going on? You have over tens of millions of years, you have a huge climatic transition that is essentially paced by CO2. And not only your climate is changing, your environment is changing, and it's shaping the way and what life forms evolve.
So rather than CO2 being a result or a symptom of these huge geological changes, you're saying actually it's CO2 levels that is driving a lot of this change.
Yes, well, yes, it is definitely shaping the climate, but it's very hard to, I guess, separate it, because in the end, everything in our Earth system, on our planet, everything's linked. Your CO2 is going to make the world warmer, and then that's going to affect the life, and that's going to affect the processes that in the end end up producing or consuming the CO2. So it's kind of all a really intertwined system where everything's evolving hand in hand, your climate, your environment, and your life, and they are influencing back the other one.
Right. And so this huge increase in volcanic activity that led to the end of the late Paleozoic Ice Age, do we know why that happened? Or is that something we're still trying to figure out?
So, I mean, I did say that it was kind of relatively quick. I'm still speaking about geological timescales. Yeah. So we had an increase of CO2 on the timescales of millions of years in the beginning of early Permian. So we were able to see that this increase in CO2 correlates with geological evidence of kind of large-scale volcanic eruptions happening. I mean, volcanism is... you know, our planet, our surface of the surface of our planet is very active. Volcanism is always happening. But, you know, part of that could be also driven by tectonism. So, for example, during this time, we have the opening of your Pangaea, of what we call a Tethys Basin, is starting to happen. So, you know, you have changes in orogenies, you have changes in tectonism. So it's possible that kind of led to the volcanism as well.
Right. So essentially the plates moving around as they have done since the Earth began, it was always going to create a lot of activity, and this tend to spiral out and change the world very dramatically as we know it. Or at least we weren't around at the time, but as the creatures on the planet Earth knew it. Really, really interesting. It'll be interesting to see what our understanding of CO2 historically will be able to tell us about future climate change. Dr. Hanna Yurikova, Senior Research Fellow at the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of St. Andrews. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Spectrum Business knows that you put in unlimited effort to unlock the unlimited possibilities of your small business. Get internet, mobile, phone, and TV services to connect all aspects of your business and see your business made limitless. Learn more at spectrum.com/business.